nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
It sometimes comes out a little bit better than us in the rankings. MIT. He was a postdoc
at free school in the Charles.
It's the most small schools out east without a good football team. Our football team could beat the heck out of them. Get real.
That's what really matters, right?
That's what really matters.
I think our girls' basketball team could do the same to the football team.
Okay, let's not. Jerry's at my CLO, you can tell you all about it. Okay, he was a postdoc fellow at Harvard, where he actually got involved in, among other things, ballistic electron emission microscopy work, which I think you see has kind of morphed into some other broader ranging things he's doing now. He's currently an assistant professor of ECE at University of Delaware. And just from a personal perspective, Ian was on campus a couple months ago, gave a seminar on the other side of campus, and is doing, I think, a lot of really fascinating work on understanding spin and silicon. Those of you who don't closely follow the field, silicon's of real interest on a kind of extremely long spin coherence lifetime. So I think today he'll tell you about are some of the first experiments in the world on really quantifying that. So without further ado.
Thanks, Dave, for the introduction and especially for inviting me back to Purdue. It's great to be here. Now, probably some of you may have been at my talk in January. So for you, I have both good news and bad news. The good news is that we've done some more measurements and analysis since then, and I've incorporated them into this talk. So shouldn't be too bored. The bad news, of course, is that I intend to recycle all the dumb jokes. So you've all been warned. The door's over there. You can make a run for it. So before I begin, just want to remind you the room is small enough. If you have any questions as I go through the talk, please just raise your hand or shout it out, and I'll do my best to answer you. So the talk, of course, is entitled Silicon Spintronics. This is electrical engineering, so I feel pretty confident that everyone knows what silicon is. But spintronics is a little bit... a term that you may be a little bit less familiar with. Now, of course, it's a contraction of these words spin and electronics, and it describes a field where we control the flow of electrons through devices, not just by coupling electric fields to the electron's fundamental electric charge, but by coupling to the electron's fundamental magnetic moment that's related to its intrinsic angular momentum that's called spin. Now, this idea maybe sounds like some kind of speculation, but in reality, spintronics as a field has impacted everyone's daily life and has been for about 10 years. And the reason why is because there are effects which are evident in ferromagnetic metals, conductors where the spin of the electrons are more or less aligned. And these kinds of effects can be used to construct devices where we can make really powerful magnetic field sensors. Now, the first kind of effect was actually discovered a long time ago, about 150 years ago. It's called anisotropic magnetoresistance. It's the change in the electrical resistance depending on the relative orientation between the magnetization of the ferromagnet and the direction of current flow. And by changing the relative orientation between current flow and magnetization, changing the direction of the magnetization with external magnetic field, you can control the electrical resistance to a few percent. Now, more recently, it was discovered an effect which is called giant magnetoresistance, where the electrical resistance is controlled to a few tens of percents based on the relative orientation of the magnetizations of adjacent ferromagnetic layers that are separated by a thin non-magnetic spacer layer on the order of a few nanometers. You may have heard this term, giant magnetoresistance, because it was the subject of the most recent Nobel Prize. Now, more recently, it was discovered that if you replace this conductive interlayer with an insulating barrier, then by forcing the current to flow perpendicular to the plane of the film and causing the electrons to be transported through quantum mechanical tunneling, you could create an even stronger magnetoresistance effect. In this case, with tunnel magnetoresistance, control over the electrical resistance of many hundreds of percent. In other words, the change in the resistance is larger than the lowest resistance state when the ferromagnetic magnetizations are aligned. Now, the reason why this is so important is because as the strength of the magnetoresistance increases, the device you make with it as a magnetic field sensor becomes more and more powerful. And so you can sense weaker and weaker magnetic fields. And the reason why all of your lives have been impacted is because these kinds of technologies have been incorporated into the magnetic read heads of hard drives. And the introduction of these technologies in turn, since the beginning of the 90s, has led about 3 orders of magnitude increase in the areal density of hard drives. So about a factor of 1,000 over about 15 years. It's outpaced even Moore's law. Of course, this impact of spintronics on information technology is only on one side, on the storage aspect. And there's the other side, which is information processing. Now, all of you know that information is now processed in electronic circuits using the basic building block transistor, which by downscaling has led to integrated circuits of hundreds of millions of individual units. And this, again, is known as Moore's law. We get an increase in performance by making transistors smaller and increasing the complexity of the circuits we make with them. The problem is, of course, there's a limit to how small we can make these transistors, and this exponential increase in the number of transistors per integrated circuit is now going to be leveling off. And so gains in performance based on downscaling transistors are going to saturate. So at this point, there's a real opportunity to look at alternative paradigms for information processing. And since we know spin is very useful for information storage, it's natural to look at opportunities to use spin for information processing as well. Now, in today's electronic circuits, the logic state is encoded in either the presence or absence of charge in the channel of a transistor. So if it's on, it's a 1. If it's off, it's a 0. For spin, it's quite easy. We have a magnetic moment, so we can encode zeros and ones by the orientation of the ensemble of these spins. So if spin up is a 1, spin down is a 0, for example. The problem is, though, that this analogy between information that's stored in the presence or absence of charge and the direction of spin is not quite complete, because although charge is conserved, spin is not. And what I mean by this is that if you take a system, a non-magnetic system, there's equal numbers of spin up and spin down. So the system is unpolarized. Now, we can push the system out of equilibrium by orienting all these spins. But, of course, the system wants to regain equilibrium, and it'll do so over a characteristic timescale that we call the spin lifetime. Now, the importance of semiconductors for spintronics, then, is in addition to the fact that we have really exquisite control over electrons by coupling to their electronic charge with internal electric fields, is that the spin lifetime in semiconductors is orders of magnitude longer than it is in metals. Now, of course, we should ask, what kind of semiconductor should we use? We have any number of possibilities. We have, of course, the elemental semiconductors and compound semiconductors and many different combinations that we could explore. But silicon really stands out among these possibilities for several reasons, the first of which is that it's a light ion. The atomic number is fairly low. And for that reason, the coupling between the intrinsic magnetic moment of the electron spin, and the orbital magnetic moment, essentially due to the fact that you have a charged electron, at least in the semi-classical picture, orbiting around a nucleus and creating a loop of current, that coupling between the electron spin and the orbital spin is the orbital magnetic moment is fairly weak. Secondly, most of the naturally occurring silicon is isotope silicon 28, which has no nuclear spin. And for that reason, the so-called hyperfine interaction is relatively absent. And a little bit more subtly, this elemental semiconductor silicon forms a diamond lattice as opposed to zinc blend lattice for many compound semiconductors. And the diamond lattice has spatial inversion symmetry. And this tends to suppress the spin-orbit interaction even further. So among all of these possible semiconductors, silicon has an extremely long spin lifetime. And it's actually been known for quite a long time using electron spin resonance. But doing spin resonance with microwaves and strong magnetic fields is a far cry from actually creating a device where we inject spin in one place, cause it to transport across the silicon to another place, and then measure its spin polarization or its orientation there. And the problem has been, although there's been a lot of progress in spin injection and detection in other semiconductors, most notably gallium arsenide, over the past 10 years or so, the methods that were developed for those semiconductors are essentially incapable of being applied to silicon. And the reason why is because, unlike gallium arsenide, for instance, which is a direct band gap semiconductor with a strong spin-orbit interaction, silicon is an indirect band gap semiconductor with a weak spin-orbit interaction. So optical methods, which couple the angular momentum of the photon, its circular polarization, to the electron spin, are very, very difficult to be applied. In addition, electronic methods that were used for gallium arsenide could not be directly applied to silicon because they're very sensitive to the interface between ferromagnetic metals and the semiconductor. And unfortunately, there's no good system of a ferromagnetic metal that can be epitaxially grown on silicon. And furthermore, it's complicated by the issue that because silicon is a light ion, many metals can alloy with it very easily and form silicides. And typically, if you have a ferromagnetic metal, forms a silicide with silicon, the silicide is not ferromagnetic either. So we had to develop a new technique to be able to observe spin injection, transport, and detection in silicon. And the method that we used is called ballistic spin filtering. And I want to describe it with an analogy to an experiment in optics that I'm confident that at least most of you are familiar with. So the idea is this. If you have a source of unpolarized photons, just an incandescent light bulb, for instance, and you pass those photons through a polarizing filter, then what happens is the filter absorbs half of the photons that have their electric field polarization orthogonal to the optical axis. Now, we can measure the amount of electric field polarization that passes through just with a second polarizing filter. And the way we do it is we control the relative orientation between the optical axes of the first filter that we use as a polarizer and the second one that we use as an analyzer. So that if the optical axes are parallel, then we'll get through the analyzer exactly the same amount that passed through the first one. But if we have crossed optical axes, then what we're doing is we're absorbing electric field polarization in, say, the vertical direction in the first, and then in the orthogonal horizontal direction in the second, and so no light passes through. So by making a measurement of the modulation of the amount of light that passes through, we can figure out what the degree of electric field polarization is in between the polarizer and the analyzer. Now, for electrons, we can do essentially the same thing with the spin polarization by using not polarizing optical filters, but thin film ferromagnetic layers. So if we start out with a source of unpolarized electrons and pass those through the ferromagnetic film, then because there's an asymmetry in the scattering between electrons which have their spins oriented parallel to the magnetization of the ferromagnetic film or anti-parallel to the magnetization of the ferromagnetic film, as long as we focus only on the ballistic electrons, the electrons that don't scatter as they pass through the ferromagnet, then we know that because of this scattering asymmetry, the electrons which pass through without scattering in the first ferromagnet are spin polarized. They've essentially absorbed the electrons which are spin polarized in one direction from an initially unpolarized source. Again, then we use another ferromagnet as another filter to determine the spin polarization in between simply by changing the relative orientation of the magnetization between the injector and the detector, so that if the magnetizations are anti-parallel, then we should see a modulation of the amount of ballistic electrons that pass through. So we measure a current, and we see a change in that current as we change the axis through which we inject and detect. Now, what we want to do, of course, is measure spin polarization It's been transport in silicon. So it's important that this method is not dependent on ballistic transport through the silicon itself. It's only dependent on spin transport through the ferromagnetic metal thin films, which are on the order of a few nanometers. And as I'll show you, the transport through the silicon is over many hundreds of microns. Okay, so now, just for a little bit of background, the reason why this works is essentially because in the ferromagnet, you have a splitting between in the density of states of spin up and spin down. This gives rise to more of one spin at the Fermi energy than another, and hence a bulk magnetization. Now, because the transition rates from electrons in higher energy states to Fermi energy are dependent on the density of states there, if we start out with a source of initially unpolarized so-called hot electrons, they're called hot because they have much more kinetic energy than the thermal energy, KT, and we pass these hot electrons through a thin film ferromagnetic polarizer, then one spin species will pass through with greater probability than the other, which is essentially just inelastically scattered to the Fermi energy. It relaxes its extra hot electron energy there. So in this way, we convert an unpolarized hot electron current into a polarized current. Now, you might be asking, what are these hot electrons? How do you create them and how are they different? Well, one way we create them is by using a tunnel junction. And tunnel junction, of course, is just two conductors separated by a thin insulator. And so when we apply a voltage between these, this is manifest as a discontinuity between the Fermi energy of the cathode and the anode. Now, because the tunneling process is mostly elastic, there's energy conservation from electrons which preferentially tunnel from the Fermi energy of the cathode into the anode. And as they do that, you can see that they're then far above the Fermi energy in the anode. So they're created as hot electrons there. Now, normally, if you just have a two-terminal device, you don't see any hot electron effects because the electrons then relax to the Fermi energy by inelastic scattering over a very short distance. But if this metal is very short and we collect the ballistic electrons, the ones that don't scatter from those that have thermalized, then we can see this ballistic spin filtering effect. Okay, so at this point, I'm going to describe the basic idea, basic band diagram of the devices that we use for observation of spin polarized transport through silicon. So again, we have a tunnel junction here that we use to create hot electrons for injection of spin polarized electrons into silicon. So we apply a bias. In this case, we have a ferromagnetic cathode. And because, again, there's an asymmetry in the density of states at the Fermi energy, there's more of one spin than another there. And those electrons tunnel through this aluminum oxide barrier into hot electron states in non-magnetic aluminum and copper. Now, the thickness of these layers is very short, just a few nanometers. And so a significant fraction of the, a small but significant fraction of the electrons which tunnel through here pass ballistically through the non-magnetic anode and into conduction band states in the silicon, which lies on the other side of the anode.
So what is the kinetic energy that makes it the silicon?
How much is their kinetic energy?
What is the value that makes it?
Okay, so a typical voltage we apply to the emitter is, say, 1.5 volts. Now, the Schottky barrier here between copper and the conduction band of silicon is about 0.7 volts. So, yeah, it's a significant fraction of an electron volt above the conduction band edge. But the ballistic mean free path of electrons in the conduction band of silicon is on the order of 10 nanometers. So if the silicon transport layer is several hundred microns, then this plays essentially no role in the overall transport from the injector to the detector. But that's a good point. They enter into the conduction band as hot electrons, but then they relax very quickly. So I should have been forwarding here. Okay, yeah, so electrons make it into the conduction band. They then relax the conduction band and conduction band edge. And so for most of the transport through the transport layer, this occurs at the conduction band edge and is dominated by the electric field, which is provided by a voltage drop between the Schottky contact at the injector side and another Schottky at the detector side. Now, because of the Schottky barriers, in other words, the discontinuity between the conduction band edge and the Fermi energy in the on the detector side, these electrons are ejected from the conduction band into hot electron states into a second ferromagnetic metal. Now again, because of ballistic spin filtering, we can detect the spin polarization of these electrons which are in the conduction band of the silicon simply by making a measurement of the number of electrons which cross ballistically into a second semiconductor collector on the other side. So, for example, if we are in this case injecting spin up because the magnetization of this ferromagnetic layer and the detector ferromagnetic layer are parallel, then we should see a relatively large number of electrons which are crossing ballistically and into the conduction band of the second semiconductor collector. In other words, we measure a current here at zero bias, but if we are instead injecting spin up but measuring spin down by changing the relative orientation of the magnetization, then we should see a modulation in that current. So that's essentially the simplest kind of measurement that we're going to do. Basically, what we do is we hold all the voltages constant, we measure this spin transport current, this IC2 stands for a second collector current, and we change an external magnetic field and see how that modulates our spin transport current.
How do you assure that the current density going into the silicon from the carriers are launched with kinetic energy is bigger than the dark current coming over the Schottky barrier?
We lower the temperature enough so that we freeze that out.
Okay.
Yeah, so the measurements I'll show you, I think, are typically at 150 Kelvin. And the only reason for that is that, the numbers of electrons, as you'll see, that cross into the conduction band here are relatively small, and that would be completely diluted in the present structure at room temperature. Although there are ways of overcoming this by going to, using metals which have higher Schottky barriers. Okay, now I want to say a few things about the structure. The first is that, again, there's Schottky barriers on both sides of the transport layer. So what that means is that because of the rectifying nature of these contacts, changing the value of the voltage between injector and detector and its polarity essentially does only one thing. It only changes the internal electric field and hence the transit time in between injector and detector. It does not induce any kind of spurious current to flow because, again, the current due to thermalized carriers is suppressed by going to a low temperature and the Schottky barrier here. The second thing is that this is undoped silicon, so the bands are linear. The electrons enter into the conduction band and they're essentially just swept out to the other side. There's no band bending, so the electrons that are injected don't spend a long time in a confining well in the middle here. Now, for those of you who are familiar with fabrication of semiconductor devices, you might be worried about how we actually realize this kind of detector structure. It's a single crystal semiconductor, several hundred microns thick, separated from another single crystal semiconductor by just a few nanometers of metal. And the reason why you might be concerned about this is because although it's very easy to deposit a metal on top of a single crystal semiconductor, and you can even do this epitaxially in some cases, it's essentially impossible to grow a single crystal semiconductor on top of a metal substrate. Now, the way we do this is with a technique called ultra-high vacuum metal wafer bonding. So what we do is we take full wafers, we have an intrinsic silicon wafer, undoped, that's our silicon transport layer, and this N-type silicon is our second collector, that's where we measure our spin transport current. And in ultra-high vacuum, we first deposit copper on the collector side to lower the Schottky barrier there, and then during the deposition of our ferromagnet, nickel iron permalloy alloy, we rotate the surfaces of these wafers together and press them with nominal force, and they spontaneously adhere. So this is bonding that occurs at room temperature in ultra-high vacuum, and it occurs because the surfaces are really ultra-clean. We see one side, on one wafer we have an ultra-clean metal. There's essentially no adsorbates because we're in ultra-high vacuum. It sees another metal surface, and we get spontaneous adhesion, and we can make a structure which is semiconductor, a few nanometers of metal, another semiconductor. Now we do this in ultra high vacuum chamber, as I said, and this is the motion of our manipulator. Now, as you might imagine, as a boy grows up, he longs for all the toys he used to have, and so you might be reminded by popular child's toy. Now, after we do this bonding, of course, we have to define devices. And the way we do that is because this is a vertical transport device, we're not so concerned about the dimensions in a lateral direction. And so we use actually a wafer sawing to cut through several hundred microns to define device maces. And then after our fabrication and bonding wire bonding, our devices look something like this. Now, again, these are vertical devices. So what we're doing here is we take a tunnel junction structure on one side of this 350 micron thick undoped silicon wafer, and we apply a bias between the anode and the ferromagnetic cathode to inject spin polarized carriers through the anode and into the semiconductor beneath it. And so we measure the current that's injected at the exposed buried layer. And that's also where we can apply a voltage between the injector and the detector. In other words, we can change the internal electric field in the transport layer. And again, our spin transport signal is this second collector current that's measured on the other side of the ferromagnet. It only consists of electrons which have passed ballistically both through the injector anode and this buried layer.
Why is the silicon so thick?
Why is it so thick?
Why is it 350?
So this was done on purpose. The way we first demonstrated spin transport through silicon was with an SOI wafer that had a 10 micron thick undoped silicon. But as you'll see, what we wanted to do was make a measurement of spin lifetime. And so the transport time through 10 microns in our devices was less than a nanosecond. Here, because the length is so long, the amount of time it takes for electrons to go from one side to the other is also very long.
Okay, so, but if you were designing this as a useful active device rather than a diagnostic tool.
That's right. So for now, what we want to do is elucidate the basic parameters for transport of spin through silicon. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, a quick tutorial. Why this when you...
Are you going to give me a tutorial?
No,
I'm going to give you...
Okay. Thank you. So you thermalize these... spin polarized electrons down
yes.
to the conduction band edge, right? Why is that? Why doesn't that energy disrupt the spin properties of the carrier?
Basically, because the So the spin, the momentum can be scattered many, many, many times more than the spin will be scattered. In other words, and fundamentally in silicon, the reason why is because the spin orbit interaction is so weak. So the so-called G factor, which relates the strength of state splitting between spin up and spin down, is very close to what it is in vacuum. It's about equal to 2. In other semiconductors, like for instance gallium arsenide, it's been modified so severely by spin orbit interaction that it's actually negative. It's minus 0.34. So there's a very big difference between the coupling between momentum scattering and spin scattering.
Thank you.
Okay. Again, what we want to do once we make the device is to first verify that the current that we measure is strictly only due to ballistic carriers. So the first thing we do is a kind of spectroscopy where we change the emitter bias on the emitter tunnel junction, and we measure three currents simultaneously. The first is the current that passes just between these two terminals. It's just the tunnel junction current. And so, as you can see, we have a superlinear behavior that's characteristic of tunnel transport. The second current that we measure is the injected current. And that, again, is measured at the buried bonded interface. Now, what we see here is that as we change the emitter bias, we're changing the potential energy of electrons in the emitter cathode. And obviously, these electrons need more potential energy than the Schottky barrier height here at the transport layer. So we see no current until we get to the conduction band edge that indicates the Schottky barrier, and then beyond that, we have somewhat quadratic threshold. Again, simultaneously, we make a measurement of the ballistic electrons, which then cross through the ferromagnetic detector and into the conduction band of the second semiconductor. And it more or less mimics what we see on the injector side. Now, what you'll notice here is that we start out with milliamps, we inject several microamps, and then what we get in the end is several tens of picoamps. And again, it's because every single electron that you measure here has passed ballistically not only through this aluminum copper layer, but also through the ferromagnetic layer on the other side. Now, again, the first measurement we want to do is change the relative orientation between injector and detector at constant bias and see a change in the measured spin transport current. Okay, so this is the simplest kind of measurement we do. We have, again, different ferromagnetic metals that are used for the injector and detector sources. So what that means is that they'll orient their magnetizations with an external magnetic field at different magnetic field values. In other words, their coercivities are different. So what we do is we start out with a strong magnetic field in the negative direction, and that orients the injector and detector in a parallel direction. So we're injecting spin down and we're measuring spin down. Now, as we reduce the external magnetic field to zero, essentially nothing happens because of the ferromagnetic hysteresis and remnants. But if we increase the magnetic field in the positive direction, now we reverse the direction of the magnetic field, then first one of these magnetizations will switch to align itself with the external magnetic field, and that'll create an anti-parallel configuration between spin up and spin down. So we're injecting spin up, but we're measuring spin down. This is analogous to the crossed polarizers case if we're talking about the optical analogy. And once that happens, we see a dip in the detected current. And again, that indicates that we're injecting one spin species, but we're measuring up on the orthogonal axis. If we reverse the direction of the magnetic field sweep, then we see essentially the same thing, but it's reflected about zero magnetic field because of the hysteresis of the ferromagnetic layers. Now, the depth to which the relative depth of these features, these so-called spin valve dips, indicates the degree of spin polarization, the final spin polarization in the silicon, right when we do the detection. And that's going to become important later on when we do a measurement of the spin lifetime.
So, now, one question is, when you're doing this, do you ever worry about leakage currents that might be flowing on the surface, or can you eliminate those by your current measures?
So there's zero bias between the ferromagnetic detector metal layer and our ohmic contact to the n-type silicon. So there's no current flowing. We're not inducing any kind of ohmic current to flow, except for those that cross ballistically through the ferromagnetic metal.
Okay, so this is the current between those two zero bias conductors that you're plotting.
Let me go back to it. This is the current between this metal and the semiconductor to which it has Schottky contact. So if we don't apply any bias here, then no current's going to flow, except for those that cross ballistically through this metal. Yeah, and it's flowing in the direction of a reverse current on the Schottky.
Do you apply the magnetic field to the entire structure?
The entire structure, yeah.
So what happens to the interaction of the magnetic field with the moving electron?
The Lorentz force.
Right.
We don't see any strong effects from that. Okay. One thing I want to point out is that this may be convincing to someone new to the field, but actually this is a very weak evidence for spin transport in semiconductors. And the reason why is because in cases where we're doing this kind of spin valve measurement with magnetic fields that are parallel or anti-parallel to the magnetization of injector and detector, we can see this kind of spin valve behavior sometimes even when there's no spin transport present. This is because of Hall effects or Lorentz magnetoresistance effects. So really, one of the things that is Loctite, unambiguous evidence that you have to show if you're going to claim spin transport in silicon especially, is not a measurement where the spin is parallel to the magnetic field, but when it's perpendicular. And the reason why is because in this case, we provide a torque on the magnetic moment, on the spin magnetic moment, and this induces Larmor precession, something that you're probably more familiar with than you think, because this is mathematically exactly the same thing that you see in a spinning top or a gyroscope when its axis of rotation is pushed off of vertical. In that case, there's a mechanical torque that's provided by the gravitational force. In this case, we have a magnetic torque provided by a magnetic field. Now, if you throw in a few values here for the spin precession frequency, again, the G factor for electrons and silicon is about 2. very close to its value in vacuum, unlike other semiconductors, you get a spin precession frequency which, even in the relatively weak magnetic field of the Earth, about half a Gauss, is still about 1 megahertz. So clearly, although the mathematics is very similar, the scale of the frequency of precession is very different. So what do we want to do? Let me stop this here. Again, we're injecting spin-polarized electrons with a tunnel junction, and then in the presence of a magnetic field that is parallel to the direction of the electric field and hence parallel to the velocity, so there's no Lorentz force, certainly in this case, we have electron spin. Hopefully you can see this arrow. And because the spin direction is perpendicular to the magnetic field direction, we get precession, so that during the transport, this spin is rotating around. And then we detect at our detector side a current which is dependent on the relative orientation, the projection of the final spin direction on the magnetization of the detector. So typically what we want to do is, again, we want to be able to make a similar measurement as we did in the in-plane spin valve case. We want to change the value and polarity of an external magnetic field and see what the output of our device is. Now, in this case, what we're doing is we're changing the spin precession frequency by changing the magnetic field strength and direction. And we have a relatively fixed transit time. So as we change the magnetic field, what we're doing is we're changing the final spin angle. We're changing the orientation at which the average electron arrives at the detector. So as we change the magnetic field, orientation is just rotating around the unit circle. But then we project that orientation onto the measurement axis. And so we should just get output which is proportional to a cosine of omega t. And again, omega is equal to g mu b times the magnetic field divided by h bar. And the importance of this is that we can determine from a measurement of the magnetic field period between adjacent oscillation extrema what the transit time is. So this is a DC measurement. But by changing an external magnetic field, we're changing the precession angle through which the spin has rotated, and we can figure out how long it took for the electrons to pass through the device. Now, this unfortunately isn't the complete story, and the reason why is because although, of course, there's drift which dominates transport in these devices because we're applying a voltage which gives an internal electric field, there's also the effects of diffusion. So that if you have an ensemble of electrons which all start out at the injector at the same time with the same spin orientation, then as this essentially Dirac delta ensemble moves according to drift towards the detector, it also spreads out and gets squatter according to diffusion. So obviously the leading edge and the trailing edge arrive at the detector in different times. So there's an uncertainty in transit time, which then translates into an uncertainty in spin angle. And once that spin angle is projected onto the measurement direction, we can get partial cancellation of our signal. And this is especially important when the magnetic field strength is larger, because with a fixed transit time uncertainty, as the frequency gets larger, the uncertainty in the angle also grows. So what happens is the magnitude of these oscillations gets smaller and smaller as the strength of the magnetic field you use to create the oscillations increases. And this is something called spin dephasing. It's a suppression of these kinds of oscillations. It's an increase in the observed spin decoherence as we increase the strength of the magnetic field we use to cause precession. Now we can be a little bit more quantitative simply by adding up all of these cosine omega t contributions from electrons with a definite transit time, just weight them by the distribution function, which is simply the Green's function of the spin drift diffusion equation. Now, all of you should recognize this as simply analogous to minority carrier drift diffusion equation. So the solution should also be familiar. It's just a Gaussian which moves at speed v determined by drift, and it gets wider according to the diffusion coefficient. And its total strength, the area under the curve, decreases according to the spin lifetime. Here, tau SF, or tau, the spin flip lifetime. Okay, so if you do the measurement, we see exactly what we expect. essentially a modulated cosine function, where as we increase the strength of the magnetic field used to cause spin precession, the strength of the oscillations we see decreases. And the extrema are integer multiples of pi radian rotation. So for instance, this peak here is at zero magnetic field, so there's no spin precession. That's spin precession angle zero. But the first minima here is pi precession, pi radian precession angle, 2 pi, 3 pi, 4 pi, 5 pi, 6 pi, etc. Okay? And the degree up to which we see this dephasing indicates the level of coherence as these spins are precessing through the structure. Now, we can model this behavior using this integral expression I just showed you, and we get fairly good agreement, as you can see, between this gray experimental line and the red theoretical line. Now, one thing that you might be wondering about is that, again, this is results of spin transport through 350 microns of silicon. This is by far the longest distance through which spin has been transported, coherently transported, in the solid state. And you might be wondering why it is that we see such high level of coherence, despite the fact that it takes a relatively long amount of time for the electrons to go from the injector to the detector. There should be a lot of diffusion there, and so hence a lot of dephasing. Well, if you take a look at this expression, if the spin lifetime is relatively long, then we can ignore this. It's essentially equal to 1 over the time scale of the transport. And then from what remains, we have an invariance to a transformation. If the length is increased by a factor A, then as long as the velocity decreases by the same factor and the precession frequency is scaled by the square of that factor, then this is invariant up to an overall constant. In other words, by increasing the length between injector and detector, we do nothing except for the fact that we change the scale of the magnetic field which is required to cause the same amount of precession. We see the same number of oscillations, in other words. Now, the first two elements of this transformation are given simply by Ohm's law at constant voltage, and the last one is simply allowed by making your measurement at quadratically smaller magnetic fields. Now, obviously, length does not control the level of dephasing in the ohmic regime, but the voltage that you apply certainly does. And so what you can see here is that at a relatively small voltage, we see relatively few oscillation extrema, a larger level of dephasing. But as the voltage increases to the point where we go to a very high voltage here, we see a really unprecedented level of spin coherence and transport through a semiconductor. In this case, something like 15 full rotations are evident before dephasing kills a signal. Okay, so what I've discussed so far is control of the spin angle by changing magnetic field, which then changes a spin precession frequency. What we can do instead, however, is control the spin angle not through omega, the spin precession frequency, but through tau, the transit time. And we do that not by controlling a magnetic field, but by controlling an electric field. In other words, if we hold the magnetic field constant, then we can imagine that these oscillations that we see in precession measurements will then pass through our fixed point as we change the electric field. And as we do that, we should see oscillations in the output. Not equally spaced, but oscillations which indicate the average value of the spin, which is arriving at the detector at that value of transit time. Now, we can be a little bit more exact about this using our integral expression model. And so basically what we see is if we fix the magnetic field at 200 Gauss, then under conditions of a drift velocity here at A, about 3/10 to the 6 centimeters per second, then we're at a maximum. So that corresponds to spin up. But if we increase the drift velocity a little bit, then what happens is that the spacing between these oscillations increases. And so then at this point, 200 Gauss corresponds to a minimum. That's spin down. So if we continue to increase the drift velocity by increasing the voltage and hence the electric field, then we start seeing these oscillations in the output. Now, take a look at this results of simulation. We've also done this in experiment, and we see essentially the same thing. So what this means is that we can use a local voltage to control the spin orientation by having a fixed spin precession frequency with a fixed magnetic field, and do everything essentially on the chip with application of voltage and changing electric field to control the transit time. Okay, so I've been discussing a little bit about spin precession measurements, and these are usually done in, well, all the ones I've shown you so far are done in magnetic fields which are entirely out of the plane. And this takes advantage of a certain number of two important symmetries of the problem. The first is that there's a rotational symmetry of spins that lie in the plane. And this is something, and this is reflected in the symmetry of the measurement that we make. There's also another symmetry, which is the symmetry between above and below the plane. Now, the first rotational symmetry, gives a symmetry across the horizontal axis in the measurement that we make. In other words, even multiples of pi radian rotation are equivalent to odd multiples of pi rotation. It doesn't matter whether the spin is pointing this direction or in this direction. So we see we have this mirror symmetry, at least in the envelope function. Now, the symmetry between above and below the plane is reflected in the fact that we now have a symmetry between positive and negative magnetic field values, which control the direction of the magnetic field, either above or below the plane. Now, we can break one of these symmetries, the rotational symmetry in the plane, simply by applying a fixed bias field that lies in the plane. And in this case, what happens, of course, is that the effective magnetic field is now no longer purely out of the plane, it's oblique. And so spins will precess around that, which is just the vector sum of the fixed bias field and the applied magnetic field out of the plane. And because we've broken the symmetry, what happens is we break the symmetry in the measurement as well. Now we no longer have symmetry between even and odd multiples of pi spin rotation. And furthermore, because the spins are now precessing around an oblique magnetic field, their projection onto the measurement axis is no longer varying between positive and negative. It's confined completely to one polarity. And so what happens is you get a suppression of the oscillation magnitude for small applied magnetic fields. So that's what we see here, a breaking of the symmetry and a suppression of oscillations that are close to zero magnetic field, so that as you increase the strength of the magnetic field, you push out the oscillations close to zero farther and farther, to the point where if the external magnetic field grows to a large enough degree, this region of suppressed oscillation extends out to where dephasing takes over, and you don't see any oscillations really at all. Now, as you can compare here, we have experiment on the left, model on the right, we get pretty good results. And so our understanding of the spin transport, strictly by making use of drift diffusion theory, is pretty good to first order. Now, again, there's another symmetry which we've made use of, which is the fact that there's this symmetry between above and below the plane. In other words, it doesn't matter whether you apply a positive magnetic field or a negative magnetic field. It doesn't matter whether you're creating positive positive spin precession angle or a negative spin precession angle. And the way we break that symmetry is simply by rotating the device plane relative to the applied magnetic fields. And the reason why this works is because then our applied bias field now has a component of its magnetic field that's out of the plane. So it creates a preferred direction. And when we do this, again, we break the symmetry between negative and positive magnetic fields. And you can see that when we misalign by a large amount, now we no longer have the equivalence between oscillations on the left and oscillations on the right. And again, simply by using this simple model, we get pretty good agreement between the experiment and the theory. Now, I think this is the last thing I'll talk about. And I mentioned before that we wanted to make a measurement of the spin lifetime of electrons in silicon. This is really the fundamental intrinsic advantage of using silicon to begin with. Now, as I mentioned, we can make a measurement of the amount of time it takes for electrons to be transported from injector to detector simply by doing a precession measurement and measuring the magnetic field period between the oscillations that we see. We can also make a measurement of the spin polarization by determining the relative depth of these spin valve features that we see in measurements using a magnetic field that's in the plane. Now, again, we get transit time from here, spin polarization from here. We can then couple those two numbers at constant temperature and constant accelerating voltage, a constant electric field, and we can plot this on the plane. Then, by changing the voltage at constant temperature, if we increase the voltage, we increase the electric field, and hence increase the drift velocity and reduce the transit time. And what we see is that as we make these measurements over and over again, the transit time does decrease, but also the spin polarization increases. And then we can repeat this kind of measurement at different temperatures and fit the constant temperature data to an exponential spin decay model. And the time scale over which the spin decays is, of course, the spin lifetime. Now, what you'll notice here is that the spin lifetimes as a function of temperature are actually quite high. In this case, several hundreds of nanoseconds, which is several orders larger than, say, gallium arsenide, semiconductors which are more familiar for spintronics. Now, notably, measurements of spin lifetime using electron spin resonance agree with this behavior very well for large temperatures, but not at low temperatures. And the fundamental reason why is because our technique is entirely dependent on the measurement of spin lifetime of conduction electrons, whereas in electron spin resonance, there's essentially no transport at all. You don't have a device, you just have a big hunk of silicon. And so the measurement of spin lifetime, simply by making a measurement of the absorption line width, is complicated by the presence of bound electrons, for instance, electrons which are not contributing to conduction in real devices. Now, this is the end of my talk, and so you might...
So this Yaffet theory,
yeah.
Was it no adjustable parameters, or was it just a fit to this...
There's an overall constant, yeah. So that's right. So you know about this. I forgot to mention that... So our data are these black dots here. And there has been a theory since the 60s, done by Yaffet, of spin lifetime as a function of temperature in indirect bandgap semiconductors, which is applicable to silicon, in which the temperature behavior of spin lifetime is predicted to be to temperature to the inverse 5/2 power. Now, if you fit a function into the temperature to inverse 5/2 power, this is what you get. You get this blue line. Now, it's true that the overall constant is still off by a factor of 5. So Yaffet would predict that we should see spin lifetimes which are still 5 times larger than we see here. But we're in the general ballpark, and because our spin injector and our spin detector are not perfectly efficient, what we do really is we set a lower bound. But the temperature trend here is entirely consistent with theory that's been known for several decades. It's just that the only other way that the spin lifetime could be measured, electron spin resonance, gave somewhat contradictory results. You reduce the temperature, but the spin lifetime goes down. And I think that's been complicated by the fact that you're not just measuring electrons which are contributing to conduction. Okay, so you might be wondering, since I started the talk by saying we're going to use silicon as a materials basis for something useful by using the spin polarization of electrons, how much closer we are to the day in which we can go into a store and buy a spintronic transistor or even a spintronic computer. And the reason why you might be wondering that is, of course, from what I showed you, we have a 4-terminal device that by itself is not really useful for anything. But what I like to do is make an appeal to history to point out that there has been another 4-terminal device which by itself was completely useless, but which by what it taught really changed the course of electronics. And this device was one that was used by Haynes and Shockley almost 60 years now ago. And the device was used to make measurements of minority carrier transport in semiconductors. So what they did was they injected a pulse of electrons into p-type germanium. And then in the presence of an electric field, they could measure how long it took for the pulse to make it to the detector over a certain distance in a fixed electric field, so they could determine the minority carrier mobility. They could also, by making a measurement of the extent to which this pulse spread out, determine the diffusion coefficient of minority carriers. And by simply integrating under the curve and changing the electric field, they could determine the minority carrier lifetime. Now, hopefully what you see is that we've essentially done exactly the same thing, but using spin in semiconductors, not minority carrier lifetime. Now, of course, this is the good news and the bad news. The good news is that just a few years after this experiment was done, you could go into any electronics store and buy a bipolar transistor. The bad news is that, as you can see, electronics has had 60 years to be perfected. And so the degree to which spintronics will really overtake electronics is still open to debate. So I think I'll end there, specifically by acknowledging especially my first graduate student who got his PhD just a few months ago, my collaborator, Dow Monsma of Cambridge Nanotech, and the rest of my group, generous funding by several agencies. So if you're interested in a few references, I'll just leave this up, and I'd be happy to answer any remaining questions. Oh, thanks.
So it seems like the make or break point why you succeeded where the other groups failed was the hot electron injection. So then if you decrease the voltage across the electric barrier, do you in fact see that polarization goes down?
Yes. Yes. Actually, the paper is not here. It was also an APL last year in which we used this kind of magnetic tunnel junction type of spin injector for the first time. And yeah, we did an analysis of the spin polarization as a function of the emitter bias, and certainly did find that this higher spin polarizations were obtained for lower biases. But that could be a function of the spin polarization that's first tunneling across, and it could also be due to relaxation, the level of relaxation in the conduction band before it gets to the conduction band edge. Yes.
The closer you are to just
the closer the Fermi energy of the cathode is to the conduction band of the silicon, the higher spin polarization is injected. But what I'm saying is that there are two things which may contribute to this. The first is that in magnetic tunnel junctions, you get higher magnetoresistance effects for lower biases. And in other words, the spin polarization is stronger for lower biases. That's the initial spin polarization before you're talking about semiconductors at all. But there could also be an effect in which case there's some residual residual influence of the relaxation, the number of relaxation events that the electrons need to undergo in order to get to the conduction band edge. So I would say it's not determined, but it's likely more due to the first than the second.
Could you go back to your structure again? I have a couple questions about it. Make sure I understand it.
Let me go to this one.
There you go. All right. So now this idea of the so I inject these things with kinetic energy, and the ones that are at the lower density states, they fall into the metal. So only I have one polarization coming.
Okay. So I pulled a trick here in that I introduced this ballistic spin filtering by saying that you could use it for polarization and analysis. But in the actual devices that I'm describing here, I'm not using ballistic spin filtering for the injection part. I'm only using it for the detector part.
Okay.
So what happens is here, basically, is I don't start with unpolarized spins. I start with polarized spins, and I inject them as hot electrons into the conduction band. Okay, they go to the other side. And then, yes, I use this asymmetry and the scattering between spin up and spin down to analyze them on the other side.
You start with, say, spin up. So I have a stupid question. Why do you have the aluminum Is that copper? I can't tell from
copper. That. Copper here, yeah.
So why don't I just put the silicon next to the aluminum oxide?
Yeah, that can be done, except for the fact that with this four-terminal device, we can decouple the amount of current that's flowing the conduction band with the electric field. So, yeah, if you put this aluminum oxide barrier directly on here, you're tunneling from the ferromagnet directly into the conduction band. You should be able to increase the injected current by many orders of magnitude. But if you're interested in elucidating the transport properties, then you kind of have a problem.
This is a spectrometer as you're making it right now.
That's right.
Got it.
That's right.
Okay.
That's
Thank
right.
You.
Yeah.
Does the spin transport show any function or relation to the type of silicon wafer you're using, like a 001 versus 111 like crystal?
We've only done measurements on 100. Yeah.
And what about the ferromagnet, the metal film? Is there any dependence on the degree of polycrystallinity versus if you can
Yeah, certainly there's domains in our ferromagnetic structure, and so this is going to reduce the observed spin polarization because the magnetizations are not all in one direction. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And by the way, your question about the orientation, certainly you would see an effect of the fact that the drift velocity is different in different crystallographic orientations. I think that would be the major issue. Which obviously is something that's we can handle very clearly because we can make measurements of the velocity. So in other words, at fixed bias, the spacing in between these oscillations will be different, slightly different for 100 and 111.
Do you anticipate in a mass production context that you could use that mechanical bonding technique to make billions of transistors?
In a mass production context, I would say that we would have to come up with an alternative method of spin detection because this is, at the moment, too inefficient. We're way below unity gain. And the reason why, obviously, is because there's only a small fraction of the electrons which pass ballistically without scattering through these thin films. So we're not there yet. But give me enough time. I'll take care of that problem. Anyone else? Okay, so thanks for listening.